Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey and Shad here, your hosts for this weekend show. This weekend show, we are going to be focusing a lot on the resource sector, not so much on the precious metals. I know they keep on running. Precious metals stocks are doing really well, but we're trying to look into some other resource sectors that could offer, let's say, better value or some better opportunities for investors, because these sectors, these stocks haven't run nearly as much as gold and silver stocks. We're in October. It has been quite the year for, I think, all resource investors. The CRB index keeps on moving higher, and that's without the support of energy, which is its largest component. So that means that as much as we are focused on precious metals and as much money is being made in those stocks, I think there are these other opportunities in some other areas. To kick off the show, we're chatting with Brian Lanny. Brian is the founder and editor of the Junior Stock Review. Brian, we both spent some time with you at the recent Metals Investor Forum that was last weekend. Shad and I already shared our thoughts on that conference on a KER market quick take that we posted on Tuesday. Please, everyone, go back and listen to that. But Brian, let's hand the floor over to you. Your takeaway from that MIF conference last weekend in Vancouver.
First, thanks for having me, guys. I think it was a great conference. It was a great 2 days, especially the Friday, where there seemed to be like an even better audience that showed up to watch presentations and sort of chat. And I'm super happy with it, especially when you see sort of, and what I would say, correlate reaction to the presentations that I gave and the companies that were there with me, which were Surge and Group 11, especially in Surge's case, where to me, a lot of that volume that we've seen for the last few days is probably, you know, resonating from the message that was sort of brought on Friday from my presentation and theirs. And then, of course, other people sort of picking it up. So that is the hallmark of people with good sentiment that are seeing, you know, prices move, not necessarily in copper or the other metals, but certainly precious metals, and, you know, putting their money to work. And, you know, part of my presentation was about sort of taking profits away from stuff that we've done really well in precious metals and looking for what is cheap. And to me, that's what you have to do in the junior resource sector to be continually successful. If you look at the stuff that's happened in precious metals, how valuations are seemingly moving up every single day, regardless of whether there's news flow, these are really hard, you know, places in the market to pick companies that are, you know, the bull markets. That's like the prototypical thing you don't want to do, is get too obsessed with stuff that's got the momentum. Look for things that are cheap. And again, that's where I think copper is. That's where I think nickel is. That's where I think is, you know, a good portion of the rest of the market is.
Brian, you raise a really interesting point here, just because rolling into the conference, I got there Friday night. And when I went to that mixer and that dinner, I was there for 5 hours with investors, fund managers, and company management teams, talking to them about the fever pitch that was the precious metal sector, because, you know, we ended the week last Friday on an all-time weekly high for gold and a 14-year weekly high for silver, and all of the stocks had hockey stick up into the right chart. So people were feeling pretty smart. They were feeling pretty good. There was a lot of glasses clinking. And I kept asking people, what's your exit strategy? Or, you know, do you think you'll rotate funds into other areas? And I found out that a lot of people have no plan at all. First of all, they're just riding it and they don't know when they're going to get out. And the other thing was, there were the other camp that we're looking at things like copper, uranium, other base metals, critical minerals. So maybe just speak to your experience in talking with other investors and other companies there, of kind of the sentiment that you got. Was there a real desire to rotate into other things, or did people want to get greedy and just hang on to what they have?
I would say most people sort of disagreed with me, and that's fine. That's, you know, I've made my money and I've made my name too, my reputation on being a little bit different than what other people do. And so that's fine with me. Yeah. Cause most people want to ride the wave of precious metals, and I totally get it. And I think, and I said this in my presentation, if you watch it, that, you know, if you're going to pick one sector, that's probably the one that you want to be in for a whole host of reasons. But, you know, I still don't know how you operate in the sector without rotating profits. If you don't get in the habit of selling and, you know, selling because of company related things, not because you think you know where the market is headed, that is, to me, is the only way that you can be consistently successful. And so what I think happens is, like, the mentality still is based on greed, like you mentioned, and sort of what's right in front of you and what's working. And again, like, I get that to an extent. It's never worked for me. I've always had to sort of look at what's cheap and sort of go with that. And if I have to wait a year, wait 2 years, that's fine. Like, if you look at where all these precious metals are, the bulk of the people that have done exceptionally well, and I would say I put myself in my newsletter in that boat, we were positioning ourselves in 2023 and 2022. And so if you look at that and the way the markets work, that's how you make money. And so it doesn't mean you get completely out of precious metals right now. You don't. But if you're up multiples, or you have profits to be taken, take them, and then look for that next home. And that most likely has to be, in my opinion, in the cheaper stuff. And again, that's not usually the most popular viewpoint, but being contrarian, especially in the junior resource sector, to me is the way to play it.
All right, Brian, you and I spent a lot of time at that conference chatting really in the middle of all these booths, and we did a complete 360 looking at all these names, commenting really just to each other on what we thought, and copper kept popping up. Chad and I mentioned on that KER quick take, there is still, I feel like, a lot of interest in copper. Everyone points to the supply demand metrics and, quite frankly, the lack of investment in copper. And it's also one of the larger resource spots. That's where I like to focus too, is some of these larger markets. But when it comes to copper stocks, we chatted with you last month. You outlined why you think there's contrarian value in copper and nickel. But let's dive into how you analyze some of these stocks. And I want to start off with pounds in the ground. I feel like there are quite a few companies, at least a dozen, that have what appear to be very large copper assets spread around the world, all carrying somewhat different valuations. When you look at pounds in the ground, is there a floor you like to see that a company has that you can say, okay, this is a real resource here? Is it certain grade that you're looking at? Just focusing again on resources, pounds in the ground, what do you put the most weight in?
So I guess I'm different than a lot of people in many regards. And so when it comes to, like, those high level metrics, and I would consider pounds in the ground, or, you know, EV per pound or EV per ounce, depending on what market you're looking at, I don't put a lot of stock into it. Like, it's something that from a very high level, if I have that metric in front of me, or if I want to do a comparison, I'll do it. But for me, it very much is like a company by company basis. That said, I want to stick to the bigger companies. If I have my preference, I want to look for, obviously, the biggest resource with the highest grade. And that typically leads to the best economics, and it leads to cash one, our first quartile cash costs, and these sorts of things. And I think for most investors, that's probably where you should stay. That said, you know, I think, again, if when you have the bottom up approach, you seemingly are attracted to whatever is a good deal. And I would say that you can still have good deals on these, like, let's say, VMS deposits. I was just in Newfoundland taking a look at Firefly's Ming Mine, and or the Green Bay project. And they're going to be restarting that project that was in production, I think, last, was it 2020 or 2021, before it went on care and maintenance. And they've done an astonishing job, and they've added, you know, 60 million tons to the resource, and they've got all that infrastructure. And I would say, you know, barring a disaster worldwide, this thing's going to be going back into production. They've got a good team, and everything is sort of in line from that standpoint. But when you compare it to a billion ton porphyry, it's actually quite small at 60 million tons at, I think it's collectively, it's 1.1% copper equivalent, but it's something that works. And especially when you have the infrastructure, like, that story just works, and what it means to that community. And so when you get into the story of each of these individual companies, you can sort of put together reasons why things are going to work. And outside being super big, which is, again, where most money is going to flow, I think you have to have sort of nuanced points to points to the company that make it stand out or make you that more apt to be right. And again, Firefly, I think, is one of those companies that are you know, the stars are aligned in terms of the resource size, the infrastructure, the team that's executing, that they're going to be on the right path towards putting the Ming Mine back into production. And those are the sorts of stories that I will invest in. And, you know, again, you want to talk about the copper market. I don't know if you would necessarily call it full contrarian. I would say that, like, maybe a market like nickel is definitely more contrarian, where there's not a lot of people out there toting nickel. Whereas on the copper side, I think some people have had some success, and I wouldn't discount that. There's certain stories, there's certain discoveries out there that have garnered attention. And so to me, the copper market is probably much like it was last year, where you have some people that have made some money, but the vast majority haven't. And therefore, you still have those sort of contrarian opportunities in terms of valuation. But the market or the outlook on copper is still pretty good. And I think rightfully so. The copper market, especially when you look at the sources of demand going forward, I think AI is that one that really stands out as being discounted or really not factored fully into what might be the biggest driver of copper moving forward. And then the other side is you look at the issues at Grasberg on the supply side and you think, oh, wow, you know what? This copper market might get super hot, super quick, and really catch people off guard that are just completely focused on precious metals and sort of have discounted some of the really great opportunities in the copper market.
Yeah, a lot of solid points there, Brian, about the supply and demand and how it's not really totally contrarian like nickel is or like lithium has been this year. It's kind of in the middle of the camp, but it has that big growth trajectory in front of it because of all the fundamentals for the sector. But you said something important when you were talking about Firefly, and that's the importance of infrastructure. The thing with copper projects is some of these things are huge and they really need majors to advance them, or they are held by majors, which means a lot of retail investors are not interested in them. So the ones that people gravitate to are the kind of the mid-sized copper projects. And you could put a lot of the Canadian projects in that camp, or, you know, some of the ones you find in the US and Arizona. They're not like the giant ones you see in Chile or Peru or Argentina. But infrastructure becomes important no matter where a copper project is at. So the access to water, the access to skilled labor, the access to power. Is it going to be a huge disturbance? Can it get a social license? So maybe talk about how you factor in jurisdiction and infrastructure when you're analyzing these development stage copper projects.
Yeah, it's huge. It's a massive point, and it's good that you bring it up. I think you're absolutely right when you say that some of these projects are going to have difficulty, even with the copper price probably going up in the future, considering they're not road accessible. You know, with these huge copper companies or these copper projects are going to be producing a concentrate. And so in most regards, they're going to have to truck this thing out. It's not like a dory bar that can be flown out, where you can have a sizable gold mining operation and you can fly out the end product. So you have to be either close to infrastructure, or you have to have something developed. And that should be one of, unless this thing really, really stands out, if it's the Filo of the world, or you could say maybe the Jose Maria, because there's proximity to Filo. These ones are going to benefit because, you know, again, you've got BHP, but that's a part owner. So the money is there, but it's also big enough and sizable enough that the dynamics for the country or the locale want that stuff put into production because of what it means to jobs. And that is so meaningful in most of South America and, you know, in North America too. But I think when you're on that scale, when you're at the top end, you can see those projects being built because of who's involved and, of course, what it means to that local community. But the other side, again, you brought up water. Water is one of those things that I think is, even though people know that it's required, but they don't understand the full depth of kind of what's happening, especially in Chile and Argentina, where you have projects like Filo and Jose Maria that don't have their water situation sorted out yet. And, you know, if you look at Chile, you're not allowed to extract any groundwater anymore. You need a maritime concession. There's only been two of them released in the last 10 years. Not to say that there won't be more, but there isn't going to be a maritime concession released for every junior miner out there. And you're going to have these sort of consolidated desalination plants that are going to feed water up into these high altitude areas that, again, have little infrastructure. They're tough to get to, and we're going to require hundreds of millions of dollars to sort of develop. And one of those components is going to be water. And so if you can find places that are let's say world class or almost world class in terms of size and everything else that they offer, and they don't have those things missing, such as road accessible, power, and all these different things, then you're way ahead of the game. But those are sort of few and far between, and you do have to sort of do some digging. To me, Hot Chili, I'm going to see them in 2 weeks. I think they're one of those companies that sort of stand out where the deposit may not necessarily be tier one, but it is a very good size. And given the set of catalysts that I see moving forward with the specifics on the project, I think that the economics and the overall viability of the project look exceptionally good, especially because this thing isn't at altitude. You can drive to it and it's going to be right there, and they hold the maritime concession. So like there's certain companies that just sort of check every box. And I think if investors pay more attention and have infrastructure as part of the story that they're putting together, they can start to see where the holes are. And again, like bottom-up approach says that you go to the company first and then you sort of look up at the copper market, and the copper market's going to take care of itself. But you very rightly bring up infrastructure, and you got to look at each company a little bit different depending on what their setting is and how they're going to try to make this into a viable mining operation in the future. So it very much matters, and it varies from company to company.
Oh, I'm sure it does. The one thing that seems to be constant with either discovering and building out copper projects or simply building them is just how expensive it is. You mentioned Jose Maria, also Filo. Those companies had big names behind them. They still do. The Lundins, major companies, are almost needed in this day to drill off resources, especially if they're really large and especially if they're really deep. Plus, all we see are price tags for these projects to be built in the billions of dollars. Individually, company-wise, then, when you're looking at the share structure and also who holds the shares, how much weight do you put in the fact that a major might already be in, or you could see a major entering the stock?
I think that it means more and more as we go along here. And especially when you talk about those multi-billion dollar capital expenditures, whether that's upfront or in sustaining or the combination, however you want to look at it, it matters more and more and more. I think, especially if you want to be on the first half of the movers within the copper sector, like the real movers, I think you, again, want to stick to those names that already have sort of the justification from some senior company. Those are going to be the ones that are going to move ahead. Now, I do think, given where I think things are headed, considering everything that's going on in the world and sort of the supply and demand fundamentals that we've sort of just touched on, I do think that more money is going to have to be flooded into the copper market, into these like larger projects that require larger price tags to develop, just because that's all that's there. If you look at how little money has been put into exploration, how little money or how long it takes for these things to be developed, there's huge lags. And I think, when you have those, if you had copper over $6 per pound, the economics, especially of some of those bigger projects, begin to look really good. And your internal rate of return, if it gets up into the 30% range for large copper gold porphyry, that thing is printing money and probably printing money for a number of decades. So those things become ultra sexy for the big companies, not only the big diversified miners, but probably, the likes of Barrick and such, who have openly said, oh, hey, you know what? That's where part of our future lays, is in the porphyries. And so what I mean by that is that the market ends up being viable because of the economics it brings at higher metal prices. And again, those higher CapEx dollars become more justifiable and probably more readily available because governments in this sort of environment we're in are looking to secure supply. And it's just so few far between because of the lack of exploration that's gone on over the last 20 years. And so that will come to a head at some point. But again, the companies that have the backing already, those are most likely to be the ones that crystallize to the market early on that these things could definitely be something in the future. The other one's just going to take a little bit longer.
Well, Brian, when you think about the larger companies partnering with the juniors in copper, it's so important, like you just lined out, that it's expensive drilling. A lot of these holes go down 1,000 meters, and it's too much for a junior to do on their own. But they're also too big of projects for the junior to build on their own. And exploration and development companies rarely have the bench strength to build giant copper mines. So you almost need that partnership. Are there things that you feel are copper majors just kind of going through the motions and taking a small strategic stake just for the expiration upside? Or are there situations you look for where you say, this is a legit partnership? This major or this big mid-tier base metals company really does want to move this thing along. Is there little clues that you look for when they announce these strategic partnerships of how interested the other party is?
I think there can be a number of points. You know, every story is going to be sort of different, but I think when you have projects that are coincident, meaning like a development project that's right near an operating mine of that senior major and who took a strategic position in the developer, I think those ones become pretty evident that there's interest because of future production or optimization moving forward. So those ones are quite easy. Where I think it might be a little bit more hidden is, you know, you have these sort of strategic ownerships. And I think one of the ones, and again, I'm talking my book, but I think it's pertinent. Surge Copper, African Rainbow Minerals is the or metals is a 19.9% owner, and they just upped that by 5% in the last placement. I think that is really interesting, not only because I don't think a lot of people have heard of African Rainbow or ARM, but because if you look at what they've concentrated on doing in South Africa is sort of being that intermediate in between a senior mining company and operations in South Africa. So they obviously have the South African workforce expertise, blah, blah, blah. And so they have deals with the Glencores, you know, on operating a mine. So there's sort of that minority. They're a senior company that's got a minority share that has the partnership with a senior company. You look at a project like Berg, which Surge owns, and African Rainbow has that 20% position. They really could not only diversify themselves, but they could also be that intermediate with other relationships that they already have with senior mining companies as sort of the operator, and the senior mining company just sort of reaps the benefit on the top end is in sort of the developer or supplier of cash. So there's like some interesting deals that if you don't dig in further, you may not fully understand the potential. And again, most of this stuff is not superficial, meaning you do have to dig, you have to ask questions, you have to go to conferences and talk to as many different people as you can and learn what these different relationships are all about. And then it can bring to light more things or possibilities that could happen for these different senior mining companies. And again, that little tidbit that I gave you is something that I sort of just got confirmed on the weekend through a conversation. So again, you have to dig closer, and there's a number of different things that I've seen and experienced across the sector that are sort of hidden. And then the other ones stand out like a sore thumb, proximity being the biggest indication of interest. And you can almost bet in most cases that if you have a senior mining company that has a mining operation and invests in one beside it, that they have some timeline of where they want to take that over. It just depends what that catalyst is to sort of get them there.
Yeah, so important for these majors to be involved or at least have that what seems like pretty clear pathway to be involved. Kind of curious though, taking the other end of this, we are seeing more and more copper plays that are focusing on smaller deposits, lower CapEx, usually higher grade, and usually not in tier one jurisdictions, but their whole narrative, kind of like these gold companies that we're seeing now saying, we can get into production quickly and we can start cash flowing quickly. I feel like gold production, albeit very hard, maybe a little bit easier than copper production, but what are your thoughts on this new breed of copper, really explore at this point, that are focused more on the smaller deposits, lower CapEx?
I think, generally speaking, I'm not overly interested, but I would say is that any number of these stories can work. I'm not discounting that they can work. I'm just reminded, you know, Rick Rule always says that small mines have the same risks as big mines, but small mines can't make you big money. And I think that sort of rings true. So if you're betting on the management team executing on building the mine and getting it into production, and that's your premise, then all the power to you. If you're betting that this thing is going to get taken over, or if you're betting that this is going to garner special market attention because of I'm not sure. I think you've got more of a question mark because obviously the seniors and the mid tiers have sort of told you that that size and sort of resolution in terms of impact to their production profile is sort of one of their number one things. And of course, jurisdiction and all those other factors matter, but size matters. And so when you get down that other end of the spectrum, you have to make sure your thesis fits what's possible. And I would say that, M&A is unlikely. And the other side, and this is an unfortunate part about being domiciled in Canada has shown that they won't let certain critical metals projects be sold to certain countries in the world. So if you eliminate the Chinese from being buyers, again, you sort of whittle down the number of ways that you can be right about that company. And when you get down to those smaller deposits, again, you have to be more right because there's less ways for you to extract profit or garner attention. And so that's why typically those don't resonate as much with me. But again, if you know the management team, you know the story, and your thesis doesn't include some of those other things, then I think it's entirely possible. You just might be a little bit tougher for you to really grab the market's attention.
Well, Brian, just one other thing on the exploration side of the business. I feel like a lot of retail investors get hoodwinked by presentations that talk about the importance of copper. It's a critical mineral. We need it. And we're an exploration company, and we just hit some copper hits. And they'll say something like, "Hey, we just got 50 meters of 2% copper." It's like, okay, but besides just size mattering, so does continuity and the mining method you would use. And so a lot of people are only looking at one drill result or one little thing, but what got Filo going was 1% copper over 1,000 meters. Like, there's a hit that you can sink your teeth into. Or what got Solaris going was like 800 meters of like 1.5% copper. Okay, there's something you can see a mine coming around. I think a lot of investors fall for the narrative of copper, but don't suss out the exploration company. It's like, how would you even mine something so small as 50 meters or 100 meters if it's not super, super high grade? How do you, I guess, avoid the pitfalls and the red flags of exploration companies touting copper when they don't have anything that's ever going to be a mine?
Well, it's quite simple for me. I know where the sort of gaps are in my knowledge base. And what I would say is that while I have, and I've taught myself to be more geologically educated, I know that it isn't my strength. And so you won't see me probably invest in something that doesn't have any real meat to its bones. What I mean is like some grassroots a copper exploration company or something that's, very early in their exploration plan. For me, it's got to be an advanced explorer that sort of has a resource or has a clear, I can see very clearly how things are developing in terms of size. And then it's easier for me to apply what I think would be the mining method for that given mineralization, because it's basically how you outline it. It can be very ambiguous when you have one or two drill holes or no drill holes and try to put a value on this thing or try to understand what this might be. But that's also why the market will give exploration a higher market cap, the whole difference between hope and reality. When people hope for things to be better than they maybe are, market caps can go to the moon. Whereas when you know exactly how something is and you know exactly or pretty much exactly how it's going to work out, you can put a number to that. And when you can put a number to that, the market cap usually has to be some reflection of where that company is in the development curve. And so that's why exploration attracts so many investors and it's so sexy, yet it has the most risk. And it's the biggest disconnect between especially the newbies in where they should be. And this is probably in comparison to like the production and royalty companies where really where a newbie should start. But it just isn't as sexy as these market caps and the hope for something more or the hope for something bigger. And that's always the disconnect. And for me, it becomes, while I'm attracted to some of those stories, and of course, everybody, here's a good exploration story and it makes you wonder, oh, that could be a 10 or 20 bagger. But then reality usually hits me pretty quick and says, no, you know what? That's not your strength. Stick to what you're good at. And that's how you've made money. And that's how I usually get brought back to reality. But everybody has to sort of take their own path towards that. And some people are more apt to invest and be successful in exploration, and good for them.
Hey, good for them. Good for anybody who's making money in these markets. Just find it interesting. And it's something that I am doing. You and I talked about that, trying to rotate some of my profits from precious metals into some of these other resource sectors and hoping that the next wave is still to come. Brian, we're out of time here. Always great and always insightful chatting with you. Again, Brian Lenny is the founder and editor of the Junior Stock Review. Click the link in the show notes on our website, podcast, YouTube channel, and even check out our Substack. We'll link to Brian's website so you can follow along with what he's investing in and all the site visits he is going on more recently. Brian, thanks again for your time on this weekend show. And everyone, stick around. We're going to be right back, switching our focus over to the energy sector.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.